Welcome back to the Mastering Your Fertility podcast. This show is all about reclaiming health, enhancing fertility, and preparing for pregnancy. I'm Kristen Cornett, a holistic nutritionist and functional wellness practitioner at Tiny Feet.
And I'm Dr. Haley Nye, a naturopathic doctor and certified nutritionist at Synergy Women's Healthcare in Portland, Oregon. Our goal for this show is to educate and empower couples with the knowledge they need to get pregnant, stay pregnant, and have the healthiest baby possible.
Thank you all so much for tuning in today. You're listening to episode 63, where we're going to be interviewing women's health and hormone expert, Dr. Anna Kabeka, about how to overcome a diagnosis of diminished ovarian reserve or primary ovarian insufficiency. Many women receive these diagnoses in a fertility clinic and are told that they're essentially going into menopause, sometimes even in their late 20s or early 30s. It's an absolutely heartbreaking diagnosis and one that traditional fertility medicine really can't offer much hope for. IVF is often not recommended for patients with these issues because doctors typically see a poor response to stimulation medication. But if you've received a DOR or POI diagnosis, we are here to share some hope with you. It is possible to recover ovarian function and get pregnant with your own eggs. The key is really to find out what's causing your ovaries to lose vitality and function and address it from a root cause perspective. So today we're going to be talking with Dr. Kabeka about her personal experience recovering from a diagnosis of early menopause, what we know from research and clinical experience about what can cause or contribute to this devastating issue, and what women can do to start recovering their hormones, egg quality, and fertility. Although we talk a lot about things you can do on your own in the episode, most women with this diagnosis really do need someone on their team who can help investigate some of the underlying drivers of ovarian dysfunction that are commonly overlooked in conventional medicine. If you're struggling with DOR or POI and want to dig deeper into your health so you can find and address the root cause, I would be honored to work with you remotely through Tiny Feet. You can schedule a free 20-minute consult to learn more and see how I might be able to help you through the link in this week's episode description. All right, so let's introduce you to our guest this week and get started on the episode. Dr. Anna Kabeka is an internationally acclaimed menopause and sexual health expert, global speaker, and pioneering promoter of women's health. She is Emory University trained and triple board certified in gynecology and obstetrics, integrative medicine, and anti-aging and regenerative medicine, and is the author of The Hormone Fix, a diet and holistic lifestyle program for menopausal women. Her areas of specialty include bioidentical hormone treatments and natural hormone balancing strategies, and she has received extensive notoriety for her virtual transformational programs, including Women's Restorative Health, Sexual CPR, and Magic Menopause. She created the successful and popular alkaline superfoods drink Mighty Maca Plus and a top-selling rejuvenating feminine vulvar cream for women called Jolva. In her spare time, Dr. Kabeka hosts the highly regarded series Couch Talk, featuring compelling podcasts focused on a wide variety of important health and wellness topics. She balances her passion for women's health with faith, grace, and skill while raising her four daughters and leading the nonprofit foundation she created in honor of her son, Garrett V. Bivens, who tragically died as a toddler. Dr. Kabeka infuses her presentations with humor, raw connection, and passion, and she impacts lives each and every day. You can find links to Dr. Kabeka's website, social media, her book, The Hormone Fix, and her free ebook, Slim, Sane, and Sexy, in the show notes for this week's episode, which you can access through the link in the episode description. The ebook is a great introduction to some of the underlying drivers of hormonal dysfunction that we're going to be talking about today, and also introduces you to the dietary approach Dr. Kabeka recommends to address these issues. So without further ado, let's get started on the interview.
Hi, welcome, Anna. Thank you so much for being on the Mastering Your Fertility podcast today. We are so happy to have you.
Thank you. It is great to be here with you ladies.
Yeah. So please tell us a little bit more about your background and how you decided to become an OBGYN.
So, you know, I've always loved women's health, and really it stems from a childhood where my mom was always sick with cardiovascular disease and diabetes. And I learned, like, very early on, I think I was 15 or 16, she was requiring cardiovascular surgery, heart bypass surgery, and she was only 52. And I was looking at the research, and all the research they were basing therapy on were all done on men, right? Very few things. It was extrapolated to women's health. And so that really made me passionate for women's health. And that's why I chose gynecology and obstetrics as a career. And I've loved it. But part of my journey and part of my personal journey has been about restoring fertility, helping women through hormonal periods of great hormonal fluctuation, whether it's postpartum, right? Whether it's perimenopause, menopause, postmenopause, these transition time periods are very taxing. And then for myself, because of a traumatic event in my life, in my family, I was diagnosed with early menopause at age 39, after the traumatic loss of my son. And through this journey, being diagnosed with early menopause and infertility. And we had lost our young son in an accident, and then, tried to conceive again. I was 39 at the time, and I had gone from breastfeeding this beautiful baby, he was 18 months and 3 days, and breastfeeding him, to never having another drop of milk, and just understanding the trauma and the transition that happens immediately with shock, trauma, stress. And I had not studied that in any of my medical education, any of my, 2 decades essentially of medical learning. And it just took me, it was trauma upon trauma. I can say that for sure. But part of this journey, Dr. Haley and Kristen, was really learning to, first of all, not give up hope, not give up faith, and figure out why, what the cause was. And again, I had gone through infertility treatments. I had failed the highest doses of injectable meds and had zero ovarian response. I was told by my dear friend and colleague, one of the best reproductive endocrinologists, that my only chance for fertility would be egg donation. And, and that wasn't the right choice for me and my husband at the time. So, I went basically on this journey, this healing journey, that took me around the world to speak with other healers and some of the world's leading scientists and some traditional medicine practitioners that had been following under, thousands of years of handed down information. And lo and behold, through this journey and some of the natural regimens that I came across, as well as my spiritual journey, that I was able to reverse menopause and became pregnant and delivered a healthy baby girl at age 41. And so, good story for us. And now I'm 53 with an 11-year-old, right? So all a lot of challenges still. I got to keep these hormones straight.
That's right. Wow. That's just an amazing story. I'm so sorry to hear about your tragic loss. And it's just really amazing how you were able to travel around the world and find healing, not only physically, but spiritually as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you shared a little bit about your personal infertility story, and it must have been just a real big struggle to have an endocrinologist tell you that you just would not be able to have your own baby. Can you tell us kind of a little bit more about as an OBGYN, you understand what that means. You learned about it in medical school. Of what that meant to you is, or kind of describe to our listeners, like what the diminished ovarian reserve means. And then there's a couple other terms too that are used interchangeably that we want to kind of define a little bit more and get clarity on. So there's diminished ovarian reserve, the premature ovarian failure, and premature ovarian insufficiency.
Right. And I think that we've transitioned from using premature ovarian failure to premature ovarian insufficiency for the most part. But, we think about ovarian reserve, and this is really fascinating. Going back to that time in my life, when I was, going through this experience and going through the failed trial after failed trial after failed trial of infertility rounds, I, you know, as a gynecologist and obstetrician, we don't talk about, you know, reversing menopause. We don't talk about, you know, like here, we're going to just simulate these younger hormones, stimulate your ovaries, you know, fool them into doing what we need them to do. Right. So we think, okay, well, yours are done. They're never going to be healthy again. Right. I basically reversed menopause, however, till age, till about age 48, and then went through another early menopause, which I reversed. Another story. But it's pretty fascinating that, again, the effects of trauma on our body and stress and how that can affect us and our hormones. And I write about that a lot in my book, The Hormone Fix. That, so, you know, as a gynecologist obstetrician, getting these diagnoses, you know, I'm like, okay, well, that's just doomed. It just doesn't get better from here, right? We just think, okay, well, it doesn't get better. And I want anyone who's heard a diagnosis like this to just stop, take heart that we heal our body, heal our mind, heal our spirit. Everything gets better. Everything gets better, can be better, you know, and I've seen since I incorporated what I learned in the, you know, products, programs, you know, the principles that I teach in my programs that worked for me in my life, as I incorporated them in others. And you guys see this too. I mean, we see miracles happen, right? The never be able to conceive healthy twins even, right? And deliver healthy twins. So I've seen these, been blessed to see these things in my lifetime. So really would just encourage everyone to take heart and continue to have hope. And then because we think, oh, here's the diminished ovarian reserve, we're born with these set number of eggs, right? I like to consider them seeds, you know, these set seeds that will sprout over time, right? Every reproductive cycle that we have will sprout over time. And then as we get older at age 35, we've just kind of drawn a line at age 35 for women. And so, well, now you're advanced maternal age, you have, diminishing ovarian reserve because it's just getting less and less from here, and your chance of fertility per cycle is significantly decreased. And so we have that naturally as we age, certainly over age 40 as well. And until we have no more cycles, which we have 12 months of no cycles is menopause. And so that's when we can just draw that line in the sand and say, menopause, look, I've been there. Right. And it's so confusing because we know women that have breakthrough bleeding, that have irregular cycles, will go 2 years without a period, then start their periods again, you know, and like, so am I menopausal? Am I not menopausal? The terminology is terrible. We have really got to fix this. We really do. But with the, you know, the premature ovarian failure is often, you know, premature ovarian failure, premature ovarian insufficiency is that, you know, our ovaries aren't essentially responding to our natural cycles and producing eggs. So we get into these anovulatory cycles, or just being anovulatory, not producing an egg on a regular, you know, on a regular monthly cycle.
But you can have diminished ovarian reserve and still have a regular monthly cycle. And
absolutely. So
what kinds of tests are doctors using to deliver these diagnoses to patients?
Yeah. So typically cycle day three is when we'll do the base, have clients chart their cycles, look at cycle day three hormone levels, an FSH, LH, and an estradiol. So typically look at those. We want to see at baseline, your, you know, third day of your bleeding cycle, what do your baseline hormones look like? How hard is now your luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, significantly the follicle stimulating hormone, having to work at this time to develop the follicles for your next ovulation, which should come somewhere between 12 to 14 days later. And so when these numbers are over, honestly, when your FSH is over 15, 10 to 15, we're looking at that, you know, that threshold of, look, this is going to be, someone's going to have difficulty getting pregnant. We're looking at this diminished ovarian reserve because your FSH is having to work harder to stimulate your ovaries.
Yeah, that makes sense.
What would you say would be the difference between DOR and POI right now? Is there a certain threshold of FSH? And do you also take AMH into account, or anti-Müllerian hormone?
So I don't know if anti-Müllerian hormone is required for a diagnosis. I think now it's being looked at more frequently than it was, you know, when I went through training in OB. But with premature ovarian insufficiency, often I think now we're wise enough to start looking at autoimmune issues that are coming into play with, you know, premature ovarian insufficiency. If we address the autoimmune issues like we do in functional medicine, right? We work on the gut, we work on the immune system, we work on cell-to-cell communication, then we're helping our bodies repair from this cycle. And typically FSH is in the, and LH are in the menopausal ranges with premature ovarian insufficiency. So certainly over 40.
And these women are typically getting to a point where their cycles are less consistent. And if they're tracking, they're not noticing that they're ovulating regularly. So that's probably going to be further down the road of this ovarian dysfunction than we would see with the DOR diagnosis, which some women may not even know that they have until they get some of these levels tested after they're struggling to conceive.
Yes. Yeah. And then the second thing is just looking too with that diminished ovarian reserve is not to, that we don't forget that we're going to look at cycle day 21, somewhere, you know, progesterone levels. We also want to look at cycle day 21 progesterone, but not just that. Let's look at that in conjunction with estrogen and looking at, you know, also, again, one big issue is thyroid function. Mm-hmm. So when we're doing this, like preparing for pregnancy, especially in clients that are, you know, have diminished ovarian reserve or older over age 40, we're looking at all the autoimmune issues. We're looking at antibodies, thyroid antibodies. We're looking at inflammatory markers. We're looking at gut dysbiosis markers because we have got to heal, you know, this at the cellular level to improve overall ovarian function, not to mention detoxification. We've got to detox to have healthy, you know, healthy pregnancy, healthy babies.
And we kind of have to address some of those other things because detoxification is dependent on things like gut health to some degree as well. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that kind of brings us to our next question. And you've already kind of touched on some of these things, but what is research telling us or what is clinical experience telling us for practitioners that work with these conditions? What are some of the contributing factors that we might see in women that are experiencing or have received a diagnosis like DOR or POI?
Yeah. So again, there's a wide range, you know, off the top of my head, you know, big thing is thyroid disease. We're certainly seeing that thyroid disease, autoimmune conditions, inflammatory markers, elevated HSCRP or C-reactive proteins. We're seeing methylation defects in a lot of these women. So MTHFR. And then, you know, again, it's so beautiful that we can look at genetic profiles now, because especially in these instances, we really want to look at what's, you know, where can we improve the genetics of this individual? So we have that. So whether it's cytochrome P450 enzyme support through natural, through detoxification and supplementation, and if it's methylation support, if it, you know, depending on those pathways, we really want to improve that, as well as estrogen detoxification support. So looking at, you know, how are we nourishing our body and how are we eliminating? So constipation is a big issue. Gut is a big issue. Gluten sensitivity is a big issue in many of these clients, again. And then the standard American diet, high levels of sugar, carbohydrates, creating insulin resistance. And that has a significant impairment on ovarian function. So in my practice and learning what I learned and implementing some of these protocols, becoming, you know, insulin now with my keto green approach, becoming insulin sensitive, what we see even in women in there, you know, that have been missing a period or have gone a year without a cycle, that their periods restore. And so like that was not really a menopause. That was like a false menopause, right? Mm-hmm. Because it was just insulin resistant and estrogen dominant with progesterone insufficiency. So we see these hormonal disruptions essentially being able to be repaired through a lifestyle, nutrition and lifestyle approach. And so that's really cool. Other things that come into play are certainly the toxins in our environment, birth control pills, mm-hmm. Endocrine disruptors, drinking out of plastics, you know, foods wrapped in plastics. All of these can really affect our ovarian reserve. And zearalen, you know, thinking, I wrote about this in my book in chapter 6 on toxins, is, you know, this fungal toxin that is in our grain. And in the United mm-hmm. States, we allow a exceptionally high amount in our grains as passable, but in Europe, it's like, a fraction of that amount. Mm-hmm. And what we know from zearalen is that it creates feminization of male livestock and fertility issues. So mold toxins are another big disruptor. And sadly, I mean, that's in our grains and our corn chips. I was like, corn chips are gluten free. Yeah. I just want a few.
What about organic corn chips?
But they're not keto. Well, that's a good question. But zearalen, you know, I mean, it's a mold toxin. So we really don't know. But
it's really about like storage and growth, and it's not so much about how it was grown or whether or not there was pesticide used. It's really more about like the processing and the storage and how it's treated once it gets to where it's going to be made into a chip, for instance. But yeah, mold, that's a really interesting issue. It's actually one of the reasons that I don't frequently recommend peanut butter, for instance, to clients, even though, you know, it's a legume and it's nutritious and it has, you know, good quality protein in it. It's like, yeah, you know, even organic peanut butter is still prone to aflatoxin, and that is not dependent on whether or not it's organic. So it doesn't tend to be my favorite thing. Plus it's a common sensitivity and allergy for people too. But yeah, the mold stuff is really interesting with food. It's also really interesting from an environment perspective, because of how we're building now. Everything is so tight and shut in and energy efficient, and there's not a lot of like air circulation and new construction homes and things. So we're seeing mold pop up, especially where we live in the Pacific Northwest. There's mold everywhere because it's so damp and humid here all year round. We get so much rain. Then you get to these new construction homes and there's like no airflow. But yeah, mold and environmental issues and reactivity is an interesting, I think, probably under-recognized contributing factor to some of these inflammatory issues and things that can be hard to put a finger on for what is really going on. Yeah.
I agree 100%. And we're in Southeast Georgia, and I had mold issue in my house too. And it was amazing because we had actually in 2015, a hurricane that really devastated our area. And I was renting a home not far from here, and it was, had a leak in the roof. It was a 4-story townhome. It had a leak for a long time, but the hurricane, then we really could see that there was this leak. We didn't know it, right? So they pulled up everything while we were living there, me and my girls, and it was black mold in everything. They actually had to take down the entire unit and like redo the drywall, everything, but it was black mold. And from there, my TSH went from 0.46 to 5.6.
Wow.
5.6. It was, you know, I mean, it had to have been that mold exposure, but just think how hard our bodies are, you know, our body is really exposed to that, and how quickly, and just, I mean, we were out of there within a week or 2 weeks, but I don't know how long I've been living in that, you know, the black mold. So for a couple of years, and just that, how that shot down my thyroid with that increased exposure was pretty, pretty impressive, pretty powerful.
Yeah. So that's a lot of potential contributing factors, which is, I think, in a way, maybe a little overwhelming for some women who are struggling with this, but also hopeful because it means that there's so much to look into, that this is not just your fertility is dead and it's all over and there's no hope type of a diagnosis.
That's so true. And even for young people, as they, you read through my book, The Hormone Fix, because I talk about the keto green way, but it's more than about what we eat. We want to increase insulin sensitivity, reduce cortisol, and that is essential for fertility. That is essential for fertility. And as we do that, and then of course, the other hormone I praise in my book, I think our most powerful hormone in our body is our hormone oxytocin, which is all about love and connection and bonding. And it's, you know, it's something that's really hard to do when we have sometimes fertility issues and sex is a to-do item.
Yeah, so we have to really re-embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you mentioned cortisol, I did want to ask you a little bit more about your own personal journey of recovering your fertility at that time. And, you know, we just named off a bunch of potential factors that could be contributing to somebody who might be experiencing premature ovarian insufficiency or diminished ovarian reserve. For you specifically, what do you feel? I mean, of course, you had that trauma, so cortisol is going to go through the roof, and I'd imagine that, of course, was contributing. But more specifically, what do you think was contributing to your diagnosis, and how were you, maybe a little bit more specifics of how you were able to recover?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I spent a long time understanding this because it's not something I learned, right? I'm a hormone expert, but I didn't learn about this. I didn't learn that. I didn't see that my patients could be, we know stress affects you, but we really don't know how stress affects you. And we're really starting to begin to know that. So with trauma, we see an initial outpouring of cortisol. And with that, we're going to, you know, just help decrease inflammation, help respond to stress, help, you know, our body, that's our life-saving mechanism. But with daily, everyday stress, everyday trauma, you know, and you know, recurrent trauma, and that can be just looking at that pregnancy test month after month after month. I've been there. I know how hard that is. Mm-hmm. It can be, you know, my post-traumatic stress that was under the surface, as much as I was dealing with our trauma and our grief and loving community and the self-care to a degree, that underlying trauma was still there. PTSD just continued to circulate so much, like, I mean, with thoughts, with triggers. And, you know, I've experienced the long-lasting effects of PTSD because I didn't know what was happening to my body. I didn't understand everything that was happening to my body or how to fix it. And so with that, when cortisol's up, oxytocin goes down. And now over time, your like cortisol's continue, whether it's everyday stress, post-traumatic stress, daily, you know, recurrent stressors, or even inflammation in our body. When cortisol's up for so long, our paraventricular nucleus within our brain shuts, says, okay, cortisol, you are frying me out, right? Like you, this is just too much, too long, and you're frizzling my nervous system. So essentially, I think that's the conversation. And so your brain says, okay, we're going to shut down this cortisol. And what happens too, at the same time, oxytocin production is also low. So over time, we would get these, you know, what stage 4 adrenal fatigue or burnout. If we look back at the original work of Dr. Wilson, I believe. And so just that you see social disconnect, isolation, depression, increased suicidal ideations, you know, burnout from jobs and other activities. You know, for me, it was, you know, I didn't feel love anymore. I didn't feel love for my husband anymore. And we didn't want to lose our marriage after losing our child, right? We really did everything we thought we could, but that feeling of love was gone. So the physiology of grief can be a feeling, or the physiology of trauma can be a feeling of disconnect from this low cortisol and low oxytocin. And you feel disconnected. You walk into a public place where you know everyone there and you're like, nope, I'm invisible. I don't see anyone. I don't know anyone. I'm not talking to anyone. You no longer accept invitations. You are more and more isolated over time. And I watched that play out in my life as much as I didn't want it to. And so that's where we have to reverse that cortisol. And so what's fascinating is, and I talk about this in my story because I really want people to understand that we can improve our cortisol and our circadian rhythm through these lifestyle changes, even over the nutritional changes, which is important. That's all about the grains and the alkalinizers and the quality minerals and quality low carbohydrate foods, right? Because sugar is going to increase cortisol. So we want to keep sugar down if we want to restore our natural balance of cortisol. We got to stop frying out our system. So we've got to create a nice, healthy baseline level. This is how, you know, I've seen it play out. And so with that, you know, going, it's interesting because I check urine pH and I have my patients check urine pH. Do you guys have your clients do urinary pH testing?
Not usually.
I haven't yet.
Oh, so it's so important, so critical to know. Like when we check our urine pH, we should see a nice urine pH in the morning and the late afternoon of 7, you know, just a nice alkaline urine pH. But many people, myself included, when I started this journey and said, I got to check my urine pH for many reasons, but it was acidic. The lowest pH was 5 on the test strips, but it was probably even more acidic than that. But what's very fascinating, stress increases hydrogen ion secretion through the renal tubules, so creates a more acidic urinary pH. Hmm. So as a marker of your stress management and control of stress, you can check your urine pH and see, well, how am I doing? So let me I'll give you an example. So when I was working through my my own personal journey, and I started checking my urinary pH because I wasn't feeling good, and I'd always told my patients when I detox them, check your urine pH. We want to get that alkaline with your food choices for support of your detoxification. And so I started checking mine. I was acidic. And I really worked to add in the low carbohydrate greens, the beet greens, the, you know, collards, the kale, all that good stuff. And the mornings I would walk on the beach, I was alkaline all day. And that's like, that made me look and say, well, how is that happening? Why is that happening? Right? That's the lifestyle factor. The mornings I did my meditation, my devotional, my gratitude journaling, I was more likely to be alkaline all day. Wow. And so we set our physiology with this. So that's how powerful our practices and our daily life can be, and how it just makes a huge difference to our level, right? To our life and our quality of life and our physiology. So resetting, so that reset, plus, you know, focusing on getting good night's sleep, right? We cannot hack that. As an OBGYN, I thought I could for decades, right? I cannot hack a good quality night's sleep. And so those are things that really make a big difference. And as cortisol, as you know, as we start to restore our normal level of cortisol, and we're not suppressing that production so much anymore, then oxytocin starts to lift. So you start to feel more grateful, feel more joyful, feel the peace that surpasses all understanding. It talks about that in the Bible. And I was like, I want that peace. I need that peace, right? By gosh darn it, I'm going to get that peace. Well, that is not how we get it.
Right.
So creating that physiology and that feeling of peace within ourselves, doing the things that do promote that, and enhancing our physiology so that we are, you know, chemically, physiologically actually achieving it, is part of the proof of the pudding, or the solution to make this happen, to increase the quality of our life and to feel that joy and pleasure and happiness that we really need to, that we really deserve to experience, yeah, on a regular daily basis.
I loved that you included such a hefty section on lifestyle in the book and didn't kind of gloss over that, because I feel like a lot of books that help women do things on their own, they prioritize some of like the really sciencey stuff, you know, like, oh, it's all the food choices and supplements that you can take. And of course you talk about those things in the book, and we'll chat about that a little bit more in a second, but the lifestyle stuff and really cultivating that sense of peace and joy and even purpose to some degree. And I just think that that's really powerful. And I think it's really important to know, especially for women who are going through the stress and strain. And I guess with fertility, there's a lot of shame and there's guilt and there's all of these things involved that really take you down emotionally. And that makes the lifestyle piece even harder.
Yeah.
The journey.
It can really spiral. And it's interesting that the thing that's going to make you better or more fertile over time is the thing that is the hardest to overcome, because the fertility journey itself is just so stressful. And we had Spencer Brassard. I don't know if you know her, but she's a mindfulness coach, I believe, in Canada.
Life coach in Canada, yeah.
Yeah, we had her on our podcast, and she had her own, you know, fertility journey. She's now pregnant, which is amazing. But that was something that she really had to go through, and she was able to overcome it herself. And she started her own podcast, which is a really nice podcast to listen to, because she talks about how to still be able to feel peace and joy and enjoy your life, even if your fertility journey isn't going as you imagined or planned. And now she's pregnant, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I think that's amazing. And you had asked what were some other things that I did during that time to restore my fertility. Definitely, you know, maca. Maca was one of the herbal foods that I learned about in Peru when I was there. And maca is indigenous to Peru. It grows above 11,000 feet in the Andes. And it was historically reported that the Incan warriors would take maca before they went into battle to increase their stamina and energy and when I was there and I was struggling with this diagnosis of infertility, I would tell people I've been diagnosed with infertility, and they would say, well, drink maca. And they said, if you're low energy, drink maca. If your baby's not thriving, drink maca. And then they would elbow my husband and say, oh yeah, it's the Peruvian Viagra, drink some maca. So of course I'm like, yeah, I'm drinking this maca stuff. Right. But so I was like, okay. And then I looked at the research to see what it was beyond it, because it tasted terrible. So I'm like, I'm going to drink something that tastes terrible. But, you know, regardless of the traditional wisdom behind it, I mean, you know, and then that's where I came up with my product, Mighty Maca Plus, which has maca from Peru, organic maca, organic kosher maca from Peru, but also 30 other superfoods that work synergistically together, was because I just had to keep adding things that had better flavors and good science to it. So, but maca science is really fascinating because it has its own proteins called macaenes, and it has a rich amount of arginine, which it increases nitric oxide, which increases mm-hmm. blood flow, which is how Viagra works. So good wisdom to that.
No, yeah. Well, and blood flow,
a bit of the background on maca.
Blood flow is really important to ovarian function as well.
Absolutely.
You need that blood flow to oxygenate that area, to produce energy. You know, your egg cells have, just second to your heart muscle cells, the most mitochondria and individual cells in your body, or is it more than a heart cell?
More.
I think it's more.
Wow.
Because it takes so much energy to develop.
The follicle, once it's growing and before it ovulates, it has over 100,000 mitochondria organelles.
See how powerful? That is so powerful. That is amazing. And we think about it, you know, that this essentially the garden of our ovaries have just designed for a lifetime. And we know the postmenopausal ovary is still producing hormones. So we keep them in. We used to think, okay, we'll just take them out. Mm-hmm. We know that maintaining your ovaries well into postmenopause decreases our risk of cardiovascular disease, dementia, you know, other memory issues, and that's pretty mm-hmm. powerful. So I think that whole concept of anything we can do to improve mitochondrial function and blood flow is a really good thing. And beyond maca, it was definitely getting out in nature, working on a meditative practice, and whatever that is for each and every one. Like, I was terrible at yoga, but boxing, my mind would go blank and I could, you know, just like be somewhere other than ruminating, thinking, contemplating. And so for me,
I need to try that.
Boxing's my meditation. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Can you not do yoga either?
No, I mean, I can do yoga, but I have trouble getting it. Like, I can physically do yoga, but I don't know that I always receive the mental and calm benefit of yoga, because I do feel like I really struggle to just turn down the background noise and all the things that are going on in my head. Like, I just went to, I work with some chiropractors here in Portland that do this really great movement class, which is great for like restoring parasympathetic and like this restorative movement that's really helpful for people who suffer from acute stress on a regular basis. And I was there at class last night and I just felt like I could not get it to turn off. My brain was just going the entire time. So I'm like, I'm here and, you know, I'm doing all of my restorative movements, but it's just my body doing it. I don't feel like my mind is with me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe I need to try something that's a little
more. Try some boxing.
Boxing could be so therapeutic. Yeah. You're just like banging away.
So therapeutic, and you get the best shoulders ever. But also, I mean, I've been practicing yoga now too for 10 years. I mean, it's taken me a long time and I still like, it's a continuous battle, but in boxing, they're like, you don't have even mitt work. I mean, mitt work, bag work. I mean, you really don't have, especially mitt work, you don't have a choice but to be focused right there. You're going to get hit. So.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, good recommendation for all those.
Let me know how it goes. In boxing.
Hey, that was
we'll send
nice.
You a picture, Dr. Anna.
Please do. Please do.
Oh man. I think you're going to have to get in on that one, Haley.
I'd be fine to go boxing. I used to kickbox and I loved it. And for some reason I haven't done it in a really long time, but it is
put some
really
equipment
fun.
In your garage and, ooh, and we'll just hang out. We don't live very far apart, so we can just hang out whenever we want.
Oh, that's perfect. And when I'm in Portland, we're going to have to do a class or something together.
Oh, I
in
like
my
it.
Garage. That would be just amazing.
Yes, we're doing it. Okay.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about your book. So The Hormone Fix is an incredible resource. You really structured this to be primarily for peri and menopausal women, but this is really applicable to this particular type of diagnosis that we're talking about from a fertility perspective. So tell us a little bit more about the book and then go a little bit more into the specifics of the dietary approach that you're recommending, because you really have a very comprehensive program set up in here from a dietary perspective. And I would love for listeners to hear more about that.
Yeah, thank you. For me, my book, The Hormone Fix, was really a representation of my life's work and my trials and tribulations and the solutions that I created, not just for myself, but for so many of my patients. And I always say, you know, menopausal women are the hardest, right? Like here I am, and are most difficult. And this transition time of hormone fluctuation is really challenging. And if it works for us, it works for everyone really, really well. It's true. But with my whole, the whole concept of the hormone fix, it is a diet and lifestyle. And I always say it's like about 25% about what we eat, right? It's the other factors that come into play that really affect us and improve our quality of life and our quality of our health down to that little cellular level. And so with my approach, which is, I call it the keto green way, it's about eliminating the glucose, the excess glucose in our lives so that we can shift from using glucose as a primary fuel source to ketones intermittently. Believe me, I don't believe we should be in ketosis long term. We need that metabolic flexibility. So we need those feasting times. And I am a true glutton at heart. So I love to feast. And good wine and good chocolate. So I'm all good for those things. And so it actually built that into my programs. So it makes sense, right? But also intermittent fasting and extended fasting. So build that in as well, because it takes a while to become insulin sensitive and to improve that insulin sensitivity. And again, we can be predisposed to insulin resistance just because of our genetics. I'm Middle Eastern, Mediterranean background. So there, I could survive the Sahara for 6 months with no food, no water, right? My metabolism will just like help me get along. And Native American Indians are another, or Native Americans are another perfect example of that, right? They are metabolically designed for long periods of starvation and fasting. That's why they have such an increased risk of diabetes and heart disease. So insulin sensitivity, depending on our genetics and our environment and some of the toxins that we mentioned, it is just critical to create in our society right now. And, you know, So I focus on creating this insulin sensitivity through my keto green eating plan, which is a very healthy take on keto, because you can do keto dirty, but keto clean is keto green. I like to say that.
Love it.
And so intermittent fasting, longer periods of intermittent fasting. So working up, you know, to 13 hours to 15 hours and 16 hours on a longer basis. The older we get, the more we need that 16 hour. You know, without a doubt, the older we get, the more we need that 16-hour fast, 15 to 16 hours. And we know just by doing that, our risk of, well, we know that women in a study that was released in JAMA, in Journal of American Medical Association in July of 2017, it looked at women with breast cancer. Those that practice intermittent fasting, at least over 12 and a half to 13 hours, had a significantly reduced risk of recurrent breast cancer. And that makes sense because insulin sensitivity, the same thing with brain health and dementia. Every point, our hemoglobin A1C, our measure of our blood sugar long term, is every point that increases in our blood, we are that much more at risk for dementia or Alzheimer's. So creating that insulin sensitivity is key. And those who are predisposed to polycystic ovarian syndrome or diminished ovarian reserve, creating that insulin sensitivity is critical to help with ovarian function and hormonal balance. That's a big part of some of the lifestyle factors and the eating plan that I put in the hormone fix, as well as the ingredients that we choose, the detoxifiers, the cruciferous vegetables, you know, the alkalinizers that are in there to help our gut health and our natural hormone production and detoxification. So that's a critical part. But then you're exactly right, the lifestyle. So, you know, touching bare feet on earth on a daily basis, right? Or getting outside and seeing sunlight in our eyes between, you know, for the early morning rays and the late evening rays to help, you know, reset our circadian rhythm. And plus, we get a lot more than vitamin D from the sun. So being out in nature as much as possible, you know, at least something on a daily basis. I know like when I have to go lecture in Vegas, like I never see real sunlight for like 3 or 4 days till I leave to go to the plane. So sometimes we really have interior lives and we're not designed for that. We're designed for exterior lives. And so we have to do more of those things. And then the daily intentions to increase our oxytocin, the daily acts of kindness to others and to ourselves that we can do to increase our oxytocin and focus on our hormone of love, bonding, and connection, and how important sexual intimacy is in our lives and our relationships and for our health.
So yeah, that's so true. I do have a question about keto, because this is talked about in a very controversial manner when it comes to fertility and pregnancy, obviously. So can you talk about maybe some of the concerns around a ketogenic style diet when it comes to cycling women and hormone balance, and maybe how your approach takes some of those considerations into account so that it's not as concerning to take this type of approach as a cycling female?
Yeah, definitely. And I think where it is challenging is because if you're eating, you can eat keto in many different ways, right? It can be the bacon and butter keto. It can be the processed food, you know, processed lunch meat keto, and the Velveeta. I mean, that's keto. I mean, give me a break, right?
Ew. You know,
it's not healthy. So think about all the other hormones that we're getting. So my approach is really a holistic keto. It's keto through lifestyle as much as it is through nutrition. So from the intermittent fasting approach, as well as no more snacking, so that we don't increase that insulin resistance. I don't believe in an 8-hour feeding window. I do not believe like in that realm, because you're eating for 8 hours. I mean, like what? Continually eating? Like what? Who does that, right? In history, have we ever? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So, you know, break fast and then have, you know, a beautiful feast in the evening. So, you know, a keto green feast, so to speak. But we want those alkalinizers, the fiber, the greens, the things that's going to support our gut, our regular bowel movements, because keto will make you constipated if you're not doing it right. And then we get that increase in, you know, all the problems constipation cause, but definitely reabsorption of toxins is one of the worst problems. And, decreased estrogen detoxification to a more toxic route of estrogen detoxification. So having healthy bowel movements is a key. So there's, you know, again, when I hear some, you know, I've always had people coming to me that have been doing keto, and then they start doing keto green and they feel tremendously better. Women in their late 40s and 50s even that have restarted their periods regularly cycling, and they're like, oh, I didn't want this to happen. I'm like, be glad it's happening. This is a good sign.
You don't want your period, but you do want your natural hormones. And yeah, they kind of come in a package deal when you're in that cycling realm of your life.
Yes. And then if some people are cycling too, and just listening, like the whole thing that I really wanted to teach in my book, The Hormone Fix, is how we identify what works for us and what doesn't work for us. So if I have many clients that do my online program called Magic Menopause that are still cycling. And what they will say is that, you know, sometimes that week before their period, they just have that increase in carb cravings, which is absolutely 100% normal. So we can do some sweet potatoes in the evening. We can do some squash. We can do some other, the dark piece of chocolate, right? And still be working to honor our body. But during that, you know, the few days before your cycle or that last week of your menstrual cycle, that maybe that's where we need to carb up or carb load or feast. I call them our feast days. And that listening to our bodies is key, and how that works for you and how that helps you.
And so it's not necessarily being in ketosis 100% of the time. That's not what's being recommended. And it's being recommended to do keto in a very green way, where still the majority of your plate at every meal is still going to be vegetables.
Yeah. And it really has to be. Men have 10 times as much testosterone as women. And so they can get away with a lot more than we can, honestly. I try to figure out, you know, so they can, you know, we have some guys, and I lecture at KetoCon, which is a conference in Texas, in Austin, Texas, every year. And there are some guys that do carnivore keto. And I'm like, you know, for women, that's just, you know, it's definitely, and for guys long-term, I mean, granted, if you're eating Wagyu beef that have been acorn fed, and I've met these guys, you know, like, well, that's a different kind of beef than going to Publix market and getting, you know, the sale item of ground beef. So you know, or McDonald's burger patty, right? You can eat the patty and you're still eating a ketogenic diet.
Yep.
Does that make sense to anyone, right?
No,
does that make sense?
No.
So we have to really consider how we're doing it and make those choices that are right. And test, don't guess. Check urine pH and urine ketones. So many people that I'll ask, are you doing a ketogenic diet? How many of you test urine ketones, blood ketones? A fraction. So test, don't guess. Really see what's working for your body and what's not. And one thing I do, and this is great. Oh my gosh, I'm going to show you, ladies. This is too bad you're not on video, right? Like, well, it's good because I'm going to show you. So let me see if I can show you. You know, I've got the Freestyle Libre in my arm.
Ah, yes.
So this 24-hour glucose sensor, it's a 14-day sensor. So you can actually see what's working for your body and what's not. And I tested all my recipes in my book and my next book coming out to see, okay, when we're eating this meal, is there any peaks in glucose? None. None. Very little bumps, 20, 30 points typically. Again, everyone's different. That's why everyone should measure for themselves to see how food reacts and responds to them. But I've become really insulin sensitive following my plan. My hemoglobin A1C has gone from 5.6 with diabetes on both sides of my family to 4.8 as of last week.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That's that's a huge change.
At 53, right? At 53. Yeah. So it can be done.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty amazing. Yeah. I think one thing to just the listeners to be aware of when, if they are going to do keto, is meat and dairy just happen to be much, because they're, you know, there's lots of fat in them, hence the keto part of it. But they store a lot of hormones and fats or toxins or dioxins, and, you know, all that can be pretty detrimental to hormone and also to beginning of a pregnancy and to the fetus. And so just like Dr. Anna was saying, is, you know, make sure you're buying organic grass-fed meats, really well sourced meats, and dairy especially as well. And then of course, really focusing on vegetables, because that's what's going to help detox any type of toxins that you might be getting from the dairy and meat that you're eating.
That's an excellent point to make too. And in my plans, you know, again, the fats, we can get them from avocado. We can get them from olives and, you know, olive oil, nuts and seeds, and healthy fats from other sources, more vegan sources of fats, right? And that, adding that combination in, to be aware of it so that we can add that combination into our diet. And in fact, in both the Hormone Fix and Keto Green 16, the Hormone Fix, I have vegetarian options. And in Keto Green 16, I also put in a 16-day vegan Keto Green 16 plan. So there's no barrier to using, again, you know, food and lifestyle as a hack to improve our quality of life and our body's, you know, mitochondrial function, our cell-to-cell communication, and certainly our ovarian function. And that's beautiful to see.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Anna, so much. I think you know, we're just wrapping up with the interview. I would say we have one more question for you, because we have this question for all of our interviewees. But what would be, if you had one piece of advice for the women and couples out there that are trying for their baby or thinking about trying, what would be like your number one piece of advice for them?
You know, I have to give a couple.
A couple. We'll accept that. That's okay.
I do a couple. It's the one is the first thing that comes up is really be kind to yourself. You know, really be kind to yourself. And then note as a couple that, you know, loving communication, affection is the biggest gift that you give yourself and your future child. And so like I know from when I was going through my infertility cycles, it was a to-do item, and it was just not a healthy time period for me or my husband in our relationship either. And I think that's one of the areas I struggled most. So till I started to really be kind to myself and be kind to him and others, like I'm a kind person, but even, you know, like I was not kind to myself. My body had failed me. I was frustrated. I was shameful. I had tremendous amount of guilt, and you know, and so I speak from this aspect with love. And then I would say, secondly, certainly, definitely try my Keto Green plan and lifestyle. It really will help support you on your journey.
Awesome.
Really good advice.
Well, we will link to your website and the book, as well as the ebook that we mentioned in the intro, all in the podcast episode description. You'll be able to find show notes for the episode, as well as all of those links on our website as well. Thank you so much, Dr. Anna, for sharing, being so open about your personal story, and helping connect with the listeners that might be going through a similar situation right now. And we just really appreciate your knowledge and experience. And we hope we get the chance to meet you in person next month when you come for the Nutritional Therapy Conference.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Thank you.